Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for October the 26th, 2020. This is Air Force veteran David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Hope everyone's doing well. We have two major segments in our show tonight. First, we have a series of interviews made by the VA about the experiences of veterans in dealing with post-traumatic stress and related problems. And then, in our second segment this evening, we have VA news from Washington, D.C. But first, let's go over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey there, David. How's everybody doing out there? Yeah, we've got a nice show for everybody. We've got some great audio tapes. And I would like to remind our listeners that we are also a call-in show. I say this every week. So you can let us know what is on your mind as far as veteran issues. Our toll-free number is 1-888-627-6008. Again, that toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008, and we'll hopefully give that out during the show. And, you know, when you hear some of these audio tapes, maybe it has an impact on your life or affects your life somehow. So we'd love to hear from you. Post-traumatic stress is a common but often misunderstood condition that many veterans suffer from, particularly if they have been in combat. In tonight's show, thanks to the VA's online program called Make the Connection, available on YouTube and other social media platforms, we will hear from five veterans about their experiences dealing with the effects of their military service, as well as how they coped with making the transition from military to civilian life. In the first tape, we hear from an Army veteran named Dan, who served in Operation Desert Storm. He discusses his problems adjusting to civilian life and how he realized finally that he needed to help to cope with his problems. Doug, please roll tape number one, Adjusting to Civilian Life with Support.
My name is Dan. I served in the Army, United States Army. I was 13 Bravo Field Artillery. I served from 1987 to 1991. My whole tour was, I was stationed in Germany, just outside of Frankfurt. I took it very serious. And I really removed the civilian side of myself. I noticed that I wasn't relating to my friends and family. The whole reason I got out was to save my marriage. We weren't fighting. It's not like we weren't getting along, but I really did start loving the Army and the military more than my wife, especially after Desert Storm. That was like the icing. That's what took the last little bit of civilian, you know, the civilian Dan away. It was, that person was gone. Coming back to the world, just the shock of everybody has a different haircut now. Everybody talks different. Everybody dresses different. Nobody talks like me. Nobody acts like me. Nobody thinks like me. I short-circuited, you know, the severe nightmares, the severe social anxiety, not being able to around crowds, couldn't go to stores, things like that. And over the years, that got worse and worse to the point where I wouldn't go anywhere without my wife, except maybe a couple, like a sporting goods store or something. When it was any place that had weapons, guns, I was comfortable. It was weird. So I became a recluse. I did drink, but I didn't do it all the time. You know, I would go out and drink, but what I would do is I would go out and go to a bar and try to find the biggest, nastiest person in there I possibly could, and I would do whatever I had to start a fight. And one night I was in an alley and I was fighting this guy, and a friend of mine came out to look for me, and he found me, and he stopped it. I realized every time during one of these fights, somebody had to stop me. And what if somebody isn't there to stop me sometime, and I actually What if I kill somebody? I realized I needed help, and I went to the VA. I never told my wife, I said, I need help. And it was hard. It was incredibly hard to admit that I needed help. I started seeing a psychiatrist, and the first one didn't work. You have to find the right one. And I did finally find a good counselor there. And then also the vet center. I started getting involved with the vet center. The VA referred me there. So between the two, I was able to start integrating myself back into society. And if I hadn't gone to the VA, I would not be sitting in this chair. When I was diagnosed with PTSD, I did get some relief because now I have something to look at. I've been told why I act the way I act. Every Marine, soldier, airman, you give them a mission, they're going to succeed. And my mission was to live with PTSD. What I could relay to another veteran is, you know, we were there for each other on the field. And now we're here for each other in the world. We are the only ones that understand each other. If you have an issue, if you're at the end of that road and it doesn't look like there's any way out, go to the VA because they have people there that understand. And they have people there that care, and they will do anything and everything they can to help you. We've sacrificed so much, sacrificing your life or your quality of life is not unacceptable. Don't give up on yourself. Go get the help you need.
Well, thanks to the VA. Rick, what are your thoughts?
Well, that was terrific. You know, we deal a lot with PTSD probably every day. And Dan really hit the nail right on top of the head there. You know, one of the things that I took from Dan's audio tape there was that once he knew, he used the word, once I knew, in other words, once he had the understanding that what he was dealing with, he wasn't crazy. You know, he was dealing with a disorder that was caused by his military service and combat in the service. So once he had that understanding, then he was able to put the next foot in front of the other one and start to get the help that he needed. You hear that, boy, I tell you, you hear that all the time dealing with addiction and those disorders. It's getting that understanding. And any veteran that's listening to this, that's what you really want. You want to sit down with a good psychologist, whether he's at the VA or a vet helping vets, center in your local neighborhood, and sit down and let them explain to you what happens with PTSD. And I guarantee you, you're gonna all of a sudden, the light bulb's gonna get off. That's only like maybe a tenth of the battle. You got a lot of work to do after that, but boy, it really makes the rest of the road a little bit easier. And David, I got to ask you. You know, I'm not a veteran. You are, and you served for 12 years and then active duty. I'm sure you can relate, not so much from the PTSD angle, but just adjusting to civilian life from the military life.
Yeah, sure, and you don't have to be a combat veteran to appreciate that. I certainly was not a combat veteran, but the experience, I think, of everyone that serves in the military is once you're in the military, you become part of really a very different, self-contained world and way of life. And it's not as easy as one might think when you leave that and go back to the civilian world. I mean, Dan, in his interview there, touched on a few things like, well, you know, people talk different, people are interested in different things, their haircuts are different, they dress differently. I mean, some of those are rather superficial, but it's a really big deal. And it also translates into getting a job, which is obviously so important, and just getting back into the civilian world. So as we've talked about on previous shows, organizations like Camp Hope in Houston, Texas, that essentially serve as a way to help veterans kind of do a reverse boot camp. You know, in boot camp, they take civilians and they turn them into soldiers, airmen, sailors, Marines. And you need something that is structured because once you've been in the military for a while, you're used to that structure. You're used to, as Dan said, having a mission, a purpose. And if they can, and being part of a team and relying on other people and making your contribution. And if they can get into that mindset, that's why so many of these programs like Camp Hope or these vet centers that Dan described, because it's vets helping vets. They can relate to each other. They appreciate the role of teamwork and having a purpose. So that's all important. Okay, let's go to our second tape. We hear from an Army veteran named Darren, who also discusses making the transition from military to civilian life. So, Doug, if you'll please roll the second tape.
When I got out and retired, it's a lot of apprehension because you're leaving a life that is so structured, it's so routine, and you know what kind of policies you have to follow, what kind of uniforms you have to wear, and a whole different speak. And so when you get out after 20 years of doing that and you get into the society where, you know, they may not have the work ethic or the work values that you are accustomed to, it can be very frustrating. As well as being an armor officer, there's not many tanks out in the real world. So I was like, well, what the heck am I going to do? My skills are with, you know, armor tanks and that type of thing. So, you know, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do, especially moving back to Minnesota. And in the area that we live right now, it has very small military bases and anything like that. So it's not like I could really go to work at a fort something and, you know, go to work as a contractor. So I had a lot of apprehensions when I got out of what I was going to do, where I would fit in, what kind of job I would get. And what I found out is that the skills that you bring out of the military, you know, the leadership skills, that the organizational skills, the commitment, the work ethic, and all of that is highly valuable in civilian life. But you have to also realize that civilian life is not military life. And so when you come in there and try to just go gangbusters on something, it doesn't always fly. So that was kind of hard getting used to at first. But as long as you can incorporate that, you know, you'll be all right. I mean, I remember some days where, you know, my guys would be working 24, 36, 48 hours straight when we were out in the fields. And, you know, if a tank went down, they worked till they fixed it. If it was 30 below zero, they were out there working and doing it. If it was 120 degrees, I was stationed in Fort Irwin, California for 3 years. You know, those guys were still out there working on the tanks, doing what they had to do to get the job done. And when you get into the civilian life, you know, you're kind of punching a clock in a lot of areas. Now, there are some jobs, of course, where you have that work ethic and the timelines and the suspenses, and that you have to get them done and no matter what. But for the majority of the civilian life, you know, you come in at 8, you leave at 4:30, and most of the people are leaving. And I find that probably a lot of the military people are sitting there by themselves in their office finishing whatever needed to be done that day. So I did find that there was kind of in some professions a work ethic that it was punch the clock 9 to 5 and, you know, you were gone. So that kind of, you have to kind of ease into that. And to tell you the truth, the first couple of years, I was a workaholic, and especially working in the Pentagon where you're working, you know, 12, 13 hours a day, 6, 7 days a week, to come back and only work 8 hours a day was different, to say the least. You know, when I was going home at 4:30, I'm like, geez, shouldn't I be working another 2 or 3 hours? So it takes some getting used to. So you can almost overextend yourself, I think, when you first get out and you have that commitment to the job that maybe not everybody else has.
Well, thanks to Darren for sharing his insight, his own experience. I think he touched on a lot of things that many veterans can relate to. Rick, over to you.
Yeah, I remember we had a veteran, a client of ours, Matt Williams, that for about 9-10 months, he actually lived in my house with me. And he was a combat veteran from Iraq. He received the Purple Heart. And it was very interesting living with him for 9 or 10 months. And one of the things I found was when I gave him a task or a job to do, so he had something to do during the day, boy, he'd get it done like you wouldn't believe. And then there'd be some days when, David, you and I would meet in our office in Tampa, and I'd forget to ask him to do something. And I'd come back, and he'd be sitting by the pool. I said, what did you do today, Matt? He goes, I didn't do anything. I said, you didn't do anything? Well, you didn't leave me anything to do. And I realized, you know, it's that idea of being task-oriented. And so Matt had to learn how to go out and start finding things for him to do, which, as you and I both know, he ended up becoming a really good singer, songwriter, and musician. And that was what he ended up doing. And once he found that, then he worked, and he still, I just spoke to him the other day, he works at his craft 8-10 hours a day. So, yeah, you need to find something that interests you and something that you need to do. In the next tape, we hear from a Marine named Marcos, who served from 2002 to 2006. Marcos was deployed 3 times and lost his buddies to a bomb on his last deployment, right before coming home. Because of experiences, he was frequently on edge, angry, and began to engage in dangerous behavior. After a motorcycle accident made him stop and think, he reached out for the help he needed at the VA. Doug, please roll tape 3.
My name is Marcos. I was a Marine, and I was an infantryman while I was in. I served 3 tours in Iraq. The first deployment, it was during the invasion, and it was really just everything happened so fast, and just coming straight out of infantry school, being exposed to combat right off the bat was definitely a shock. But things were moving at such a fast pace, I really didn't have time to think about anything. I think after my 3rd deployment, I lost 2 buddies of mine that were in my squad to a suicide bomber. It really made me question really the importance of life and how things can end really quickly. I'd been talking to them 1 minute, and literally, you know, about 20 seconds later, they're gone. And I think a lot of what was on my mind was that, you know, we had plans when we got out. We were going to go to school together. We were going to, you know, maybe get an apartment together and just live life, you know, and in a shadow instant, that's gone. You know, especially coming from an infantry background where you're out, you know, 24/7, patrols, whatever the case is, it was very difficult for me to comprehend that I could go outside of my house at, you know, 2, 3 in the morning without a weapon and be able to walk the streets and nothing was going on. I could hear a pin drop, and it was very unsettling. The peace was very unsettling. You know, just trying to get used to not having a schedule, not having someone to answer to, not having people under me that are looking for leadership or guidance or whatever the case. I think that was probably one of the biggest issues, just not having a direction. At the time, I really didn't know what PTSD was or any of these mental issues that, you know, are now very, you know, they're out in the media and very popularized. But I think everything relating to my PTSD was pointed out by somebody else, either a friend or a family member, only because the way I reacted to situations was very aggressive. In the military, especially in the infantry, when you're out on the street, you're taught to, you know, escalation of force, to escalate situations, you know, and that's how I would view my situation, my relationships while I was in the States as a civilian. So that's how I would go from 0 to 60, and my voice would be at what most would perceive a yell. So people would ask me, why are you getting so mad? And I'm like, I'm not mad. This is just how I talk. So I was completely oblivious to any of that. One of the things that I was dealing with, and still is an issue today, is being around groups of people, you know, which was obviously if you're going on a school campus, it's kind of hard not to be around groups of people. And I felt that I couldn't go anywhere with having my back exposed, you know, with people walking behind me that I didn't know. So I'd often, you know, turn around, check, as we say in the military, you know, checking my six, making sure that nothing shady was going on behind me. My self-medication was riding motorcycles. You know, it's pretty much a cliche, you know, Marine, fast motorcycle, whatever the case. So that's how I dealt with it. And, you know, I was dealing with it. I was going, you know, 120 down the street, on public street, and, you know, made a wrong move and went down pretty hard, probably at 80 miles an hour. And as I'm laying there on my back, I'm starting to realize, like, all these things that are going on. My aggressiveness toward others, you know, me yelling, me staying up at all hours of the night, you know, partying, just really dangerous behavior. I noticed that there might be something going on, but still at this point, I'm really ignorant to what it is. I just know that something's going on. I'm not like everybody else, and it's not just because I was in the military or whatever, but my experiences might have played a part in some way, shape, or form to how I'm acting now, which is becoming self-destructive. I was in school, and you know, I had a few situations there where there were a lot of ignorant students to what was going on out in the world, and the comment hadn't been made, Iraq and Afghanistan, I didn't even know that was going on anymore. And I just completely lost it and walked out of the class and, you know, didn't go back that semester. I'm 22 years old, you know, been through 3 combat deployments, seen friends go, had a lot of close calls myself, and now I'm here sitting in a classroom with people that don't really respect the teachers and are talking out of turn, and that kind of thing was just playing into my PTSD so much. It was making it hard to learn. So I hear about a vet center that's close to me, Gardena, California. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go check it out. And while I'm there, I start talking to combat veterans and talking to other vets that I was working with, and start realizing that a lot of the symptoms that these people are dealing with, I'm dealing with as well. And I'm starting to learn a little bit more about what this PTSD thing is. And I started noticing that by working at the vet center, by being around these clinicians and speaking with other vets that have gotten help before, it was starting to help me. It really saved my life, because I really, at that point, you know, was probably at a really low time in my life, because, again, I didn't have that physical strength that I was used to in the Marines, and still dealing with this aggression that I didn't, this really unchecked aggression that I didn't really know where it was coming from. And dealing with the loss of my friends as well. So it was nice to be able to get in, speak with other combat veterans, and them reassuring me that, you know what, there are others going through this as well. So it just, it was a really positive experience and encouraged me to continue to seek counseling. And after I started receiving counseling through the vet center, I was able to better recognize my triggers. Now, was I completely able to erase all the symptoms of PTSD? Absolutely not. But I didn't let them get to a 10. I was able to spot them at maybe a level 2 or 3. So I was able to understand, you know what, I better step aside, take a breather, walk away. Is this situation really worth it? Is it really worth arguing over, making a scene in you know, public setting? I don't have to escalate the situation as I did in the past. I can now accept it and move forward, knowing that it doesn't have any bearing on my life, and I can just continue on. When you're separating from the military, your mission is to transition as successfully and issue-free as possible. Your mission now is to take care of yourself, to perform that preventative maintenance, whether that be going to the VA medical center or going to the vet center, but just put the check in the box. You know, go get checked out. I lost 2 friends this year to suicides, and you know, it's probably the most heartbreaking thing, because you're right there, but your friends don't feel that they can reach out or they have somebody to reach out to. So it's important for not only veterans to reach out to other veterans, but if there is an issue, make it known. Confide in either another veteran that you know or come out and seek professional counseling. I know myself, it's helped me. It's helped a lot of my friends that have been going through the same exact issues to be able to get out and seek counseling, speak to their friends. And if you're not comfortable speaking to a friend or family member, then come to the vet center or come to the VA.
Well, that's great, and thanks so much to Marcos for telling us his story. And it's just terrific advice that I hope will ring true for a lot of veterans out there that are listening. In our next tape, we're going to hear from a veteran named Leif. He was physically injured while deployed. He went to the VA for health care. Like many veterans, he didn't want to admit to any of the other difficulties he was facing in life. However, he discovered the VA's approach of treating him as a whole person, including his post-traumatic stress, and that helped him to go on to enjoy a healthier and more fulfilled life. So, Doug, if you'll please roll the fourth tape.
My name is Leif, Army Infantry. I was stationed in Camp Virginia in Kuwait. I was a gunner doing convoy security from Kuwait all up and down Iraq. During an IED blast, the car, you know, swerved and we hit a big pothole, and just the compression of all the weight just smashed my spine. So I ended up with 3 compression fractures, a full tear in my ligament, and then kind of concussion syndrome. When I got home, I wasn't kept on orders. When I got home, I was just told, you know, wait for your terminal leave, which would be 2 weeks for me, and then just go to the VA, they'll treat you. When I first joined up, my wife was supportive. But then when I got back and she knew I was going to deploy, things kind of got a little rough. And I believe she just didn't want to be alone. And then when I left, she was alone for, you know, a long time. And when I got home, I guess me being a little bit more angry, like just in that kind of enraged kind of, I just think arguments and things just didn't work out. And we ended up in a divorce. My first panic attack I had, I was actually still with my wife at the time, and we were walking in the shopping mall, and all of a sudden my neck just started like clenching, and I was like tripping, just going, whoa, what's going on? It was an overwhelming feeling that there was like a sniper pointing at me. I was crying, but you know, trying to hold it in, be tough. And then all of a sudden my training took over, and I don't really remember much, but I guess I grabbed her and we went like maybe a foot against the wall and just went out this back, you know, back way of the mall. I was really explosive coming home, getting in a lot of fights, getting really depressed where, you know, I'm wanting to end it a few times. I was always scanning, and because I was always the front gunner up in the front of the convoy. So always scanning on the freeway, and I'm driving 80 miles an hour because I want to get through the kill zone. I don't ever want to be driving slow. And when my girlfriend drives, I mean, I'm constantly being the truck commander. Go, go, go. And I mean, she gets kind of annoyed sometimes, but luckily she's very patient. First 2 years, I drank every single day, morning to night. So I was self-medicating, trying to hide, you know, feelings and things like that. You know, I had the suicidal thoughts, and I just felt worthless, completely worthless. Like, you know, I'm not a good dad. Why, you know, my son's not living with me. Like, I'm not working. I'm, you know, just everything. And then, you know, the things I did over there. And so I decided to check into the psych ward at the VA. And that was a big help because I got to see a bunch of other guys and we were just all in the same boat. When I got into the VA, that's when my care really started taking place. And like a lot of guys were scared to, you know, go to the VA, or they just thought, you know, oh, I'm less of a man, or nothing's really wrong with me, I don't need to go. But me, I mean, I really did have the problems, but then when going through, you know, I learned the process, and it was real easy. You go to some warrior transition center, and they give you a caseworker, and then that caseworker books all your, you know, office visits. You don't really have to do much. You just call them, and they did everything for me. At first, I felt stupid, embarrassed. I didn't want to admit it to people that I was doing it, but once they start helping you and you're in the meetings and you have these, you know, Vietnam vets are helping everybody when you go in, and they give you tips and tricks and stuff on how to deal with it, but then they also tell you, you have to learn how to live with it.
Well, thanks to Leif for sharing his experience and insight. I think just a lot of great advice, and I'm glad the VA and the vet centers were able to help him out. Rick, over to you.
Yeah, that guy Leif, I tell you, he thank goodness he did get that help, because who knows, you know, you hear the depression in his voice, and you hear about all the suicides that occur with our veterans regarding PTSD, and thank goodness he got the help that he needed. So in our final clip, we hear from a veteran who witnessed his friend's death while they were deployed together. When he finally came home, he was a different person. It seemed he had less in common with his new wife than either of them remembered, and he was often impatient with everyone and everything. Getting help at the VA was the first step toward reclaiming his life. Doug, please roll tape number 5.
My name's Todd. I worked, I was in the Army National Guard for 11 years. I started in 98, got out in 2009. I was deployed in Bosnia and Kosovo in 2003 to 2004, and then I was deployed to Iraq from 2005 to 2007. I was on a patrol with another Humvee. It was just us, the R. Bradley and a Humvee. And we rolled past a checkpoint. We were in an area where there was some suspicious activity going on, so we went to check it out. And we happened to cross a checkpoint after that was over, and the Humvee behind me hit a 200-pound IED that was in propane tanks buried pretty deep in the ground. And there was 5 people in that vehicle. 2 ended up dying. One guy was a double amputee. The other 2 guys had a couple scratches and some concussions. But that was probably about the time where everything started for me, as far as like changing my life and my way of thinking and what I did things. Then I got home, and it was weird, because the excitement of just being home and not having to worry about, you know, each day whether you're going to still be around or not. So the actual excitement of being home, I think, overtook everything for about 8 months to almost a year. And then after that, you start trying to deal with the changes that have been there the whole time. You just didn't realize until then. It got to the point where my wife at the time and I, our values were different. We were never on the same page on anything. What was important to me before really wasn't that important to me anymore, and what was important to me wasn't really that important to her. She told me several times, she's like, you know, I kind of like the old you. And I said, well, that guy, he's long gone. The hardest thing is accepting that you're going to have to somehow adapt to that new guy. And a lot of times you don't want to, which is a lot of times you just resort to different things like anger. It was pretty tough, bumpy road. I just felt different about her and about our life and about the thing. Like, I always knew I could still be a good dad, and I still am, but putting, you know, 110% into your kids and then putting 20% into your marriage, wow, that doesn't work out so well. So I guess I try to just put it under, you know, not deal with it, just think to myself, it'll pass, you know. And but she'd continue to want to help in certain ways, and I didn't want it. And it got to the point where we basically just had nothing. It wasn't even a marriage. I was going through the divorce. We had separated out of the house. And, you know, kind of being there alone, just being by yourself and just realizing, you're like, it wasn't until just recently, like maybe back in February or March, that I wanted to go and get help and get some of this problem. I mean, that's 4 years of being back and saying, it's no problem. Yeah, it'll go away. Never does. It never goes away. To better the future for your family and like your kids and a future relationship, you have to find it within yourself to say it's time. I went to the vet center and I talked to a therapist there. Talking about stuff at the vet center was really, really helpful. She found certain things that I need to, and just you lay it all out on the table, and one by one you just kind of sort of set it down. You just sort of you just put it down. You ask, you really dig inside yourself and say, it's going to be tough, but in order for me to get better, I need to drop some of this weight that you carry around. The road's not easy, but I tell you, the end result, like, I can see it. You know what I mean? I can see myself in a much better position in life. Like, once you start doing all that stuff, it's like you've already dropped all that stress and all that anxiety about it. Even the fact of just getting help, being anxious about just getting the help itself. As soon as you take that first step, it is a huge relief.
Wow, that's awesome advice, and I think it was great the way he described, you know, the burden that he had as being a weight that he had to set down. He'd been carrying it for so long he didn't even realize it, and he really needed the help of other vets to help him get rid of it and to move on. But for years he'd gone on, you know, carrying the effects of war with him. So, Rick, over to you. What are your thoughts?
Well, one of the things that I was, you know, because we deal with a lot of addiction issues and the AA program, the NA program, and one of the things I saw in there was that, you know, they say all real good counseling, maybe the best counseling, is peer-to-peer counseling. David, you and I have had some people on the show who have programs that deal with peer-to-peer, one-to-one, and it seems like that. There's a lot of different counseling out there, but it seems like that's probably one of the best ones. That one-on-one, one person sharing his strength and hope with another person. And by the time you finish with that conversation, you realize one thing. I'm not crazy. There are other people dealing with the same things that I'm dealing with. And clearly that's what happened to him. So I think it's super. Great tapes, audio tapes here tonight, David. Thanks for finding those for us and sharing that with us on the program.
Well, thanks to those five veterans for taking the time to share their experiences. And as we mentioned at the start of the show, it's from the VA's program called Make the Connection, which the VA encourages people to share through social media platforms and other ways. So that's why I wanted to help promote their experiences and with the goal that other veterans and their families and friends, that their stories may ring true. It might give them some insight to get help if they need help. And if they don't need help, maybe to reach out to help other veterans, because there's so many excellent groups. You don't have to
you know,
work
David,
with the VA.
Go ahead. If I may, you know, one of the great ways of when you're in recovery, or as these soldiers were and are, is giving back. That's a great way to share with, you know, you've now gotten yourself into recovery, you're into a good program, and now you can find another young soldier who might be struggling himself or herself, and you can reach out to that person and help that person. So that's also another way of keeping the program alive and well. And, you know, the great thing about these five soldiers is, like the one soldier said, he had two friends who committed suicide. Well, there is hope out there, and suicide hopefully isn't the last resort for a lot of our men and women who serve their country. Back to you, David.
Well, let's move on to our second segment for tonight, which is news from the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. We've got several items of interest. The first, as many people know, going back to about March of this year, many of the VA regional offices were closed to public business. They were doing a lot of work. A lot of the VA employees were working themselves remotely from their own homes. The VA announced on October the 7th of this year the reestablishment of in-person benefit services in select locations around the country. So not all regional offices are open yet. You can go to va.gov, and under the find the location link, you can find out if your regional office is open in case you want you had some need to go in there for an in-person appointment. As of a couple weeks ago, there were 11 regional offices open, more expected opening in the upcoming weeks, depending on the regional office and local conditions. So that's an important development. Secretary Robert Wilkie said, and I quote, "During the last few months, VA regional offices continued performing our essential mission virtually to provide benefits to veterans and eligible family members. We have robust safety measures in place that will allow us to resume in-person services while protecting the health and safety of veterans, their families, and our team members who serve them," unquote. The regional offices will continue adherence to Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines, which include the use of social distancing, face coverings, hand sanitizer, and asking sick individuals to stay home. Veterans can continue to interact with the Veterans Benefit Administration, the VBA, virtually for accessing benefit information either online or when filing a claim online. And for claim-specific information, the VA's toll-free number, if you want to grab your pen and paper, is 1-800-827-1000. So that's for questions you might have about your particular claim. You can call 1-800-827-1000. You can also visit website va.gov, as I said earlier, to see if a regional office near you is open. Rick, over to you.
Yeah, the only thing, I had a situation, which I'm going to talk about when you're done with your, if we have time, with what you're saying here. But I just had to, dial the 1-800 number. And in years past, I had to wait on that for a really long time. Well, lo and behold, the last time I did it, which was last week, I would say I was only on there for about 5, maybe 10 minutes at the most before I finally got someone to pick up. And I had to do this twice, and both times it was only about 5, 10 minutes.
Oh,
and
great.
The second time, yeah, I was shocked because I've done that. I've had to do that and sat there for an hour. So, what it tells me is that, the VA is definitely trying and they're putting things in place to help veterans access the VA better. So I just wanted to share that because I know a lot of people say, oh, my God, I got to call that VA 800 number. Oh, my God, I'd rather have root canal.
Right.
And they were right there. And the second time I called, this young man was very helpful. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, well, the way it used to be is they call 1-800 number. They would put it on hold long enough to have a root canal done. So they could actually accomplish both things. So. All right, let's go to more news from the VA. The VA announced on October the 1st the implementation of a new information technology, or IT system, marking the official launch of the first phase of expansion of the Program of Comprehensive Assistance for Family Caregivers, PCAFC, the Program of Comprehensive Assistance for Family Caregivers. We've had guests on our show, Lauren Price, and others from her organization, Veteran Warriors, who are truly experts about the caregiver program. And those interested can go back and listen to some of our archived programs on our website, bbsradio.com/theveteransnewshour. Look for shows where Lauren Price was our guest to talk about the caregiver program. The program is expanding in two phases, effective October the 1st. The first phase includes eligible veterans who incurred or aggravated a serious injury in the line of duty on or before May 7th, 1975, And then effective October 1st, 2022, which is obviously 2 years in the future, the second phase of the expansion will include eligible veterans who incurred or aggravated a serious injury in line of duty between May 7th, 75 and September 11th, 2001. As of now, before this expansion, it was the post-9/11 veterans who were covered. Now, this caregiver program is a really big deal, and the VA just released more information just this past week about the caregiver program and some of the improvements and the amendments under the so-called VA Mission Act of 2018 and rules, administrative regulations that were effective as of October the 1st of this year, in other words, the beginning of this month. And to access information, I would encourage you to go to the website caregiver.va.gov. That's caregiver.va.gov. And if you're listening, if you're a family member or a friend, or if you're a veteran, you're listening, you're saying, well, what's this caregiver program about, and what's this so-called program of comprehensive assistance for family caregivers all about? Well, here's a summary in a nutshell, including what this recent expansion is. It basically would be for this situation. If there's a veteran who has either a single or a combined service-connected disability rating of 70% or more, and who is in need of in-person personal care services for a minimum of 6 continuous months based on either an inability to perform an activity of daily living, what the bureaucrats call ADLs, each time the activity is performed, or if they're in need of supervision, protection, or instruction, which means a functional impairment that directly impacts his or her ability to maintain his or her personal safety on a daily basis. Now, there are VA caregiver support coordinators located around the country, and you can contact them for more information, and they're supposed to help every step of the way. And that's not just something I say lightly, because when you start examining this program, you'll see that there are many steps in this process. And, of course, critics of the program focus on the fact that there are so many steps, and each step can appear to be an obstacle to getting the help. There are actually 7 eligibility requirements, and as I say, this past week, the VA released information in the form of pamphlets, which summarize, first of all, the overall program, as well as how it's being expanded from past years, and then each step of the caregiver application process. Now, I'm going to spare you the details. We don't have enough time, and I'm not trying to compete, with other news. I know Rick has other news to share, but go to caregiver.va.gov, and it'll tell you about the program, what the eligibility requirements are, the different ways you can apply. You can apply online. You can apply by downloading forms and mailing them in, or you can apply in person. I would recommend, of those three choices, apply in person. Anytime you send something in the mail, even if you send it certified mail and you know they received it, it's a very impersonal way to do it. But anyway, check out the website, caregiver.va.gov. If you're a veteran and you need in-person personal care, what this primary care program does is offer several benefits. It offers education and training for the caregivers, and this is primarily, you know, members of the family who would be taking care of the veteran in the veteran's own home. Access to health care insurance if the caregiver is otherwise uninsured, mental health counseling, a financial stipend, which is very important because these caregivers are typically giving up their day job. Also, respite care, because it's tough to be a caregiver 24/7. Wellness contacts, and also even in some cases, travel and per diem compensation when traveling to the VA's, the veterans' VA health care appointments. So there's expansion to this program over the next few years. Check out the website, caregiver.va.gov. Okay, Rick, over to you.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a brief story about what happened to a veteran this past week or last week.
He's an 83-year-old veteran, Vietnam vet. I had submitted his appeal back in July of 2020, July 28th, as a matter of fact. And I was able to contact the BVA coordinator, and I said, that's a very nice woman. I said, you know, I've got this 83-year-old veteran, and his health is failing. Can we list him for a hearing? And she said, absolutely. So an hour later, she called me back, and she said, well, I can't list him because your appeal was never filed. Well, my jaw dropped. I immediately went to the file. I looked in the file. There's the appeal, the 10182 form. On July 28th, and we fax them in. That's David and our practices, not only to mail them in, but to fax them in. And I, for whatever reason, I faxed this thing in twice, 3:35 and then 3:37. I called her back, and I told her, hey, you know, I have it right here. It's got to be there. And she said, it's not here. I can't list it. You need to call the VA. So I called the 1-800 number, and I got someone within 5 to 7 minutes. Explained it, and unfortunately that person wasn't that helpful. All she said to me was, you need to refile. So I had to refile, and I've done that. And then I called the next day and spoke to someone else, and he told me to look either today or tomorrow, give it like 3 to 4 days, and hopefully the VA will have seen the facts, go ahead and file it, and then maybe you can resurrect it and still have the hearing in November. My point is that if this veteran wasn't 83 and I wasn't looking to put him on the advanced docket, I never would have known that his appeal had not been filed, even though I had filed. So, of course, I'm sitting looking at the other hundreds of files sitting in our office, and I'm thinking, how many other issues are there amongst these veterans' files? So, veterans, if you're listening, you need to get to your representatives, and you need to explain to them that even when you are sure that you file something, and you've got a fax receipt, you still need to double check because the VA does miss it. And that's what happened here. Unfortunately, I was able to resurrect it. But David, I got to tell you, I was livid. So anyway, back to you.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to emphasize in case our listeners didn't pick up on what you said, Rick, was that the VA Evidence Intake Center, their 1-844 toll-free number for faxes, is set up so that once the fax goes through successfully, within 1 to 2 minutes, they will automatically fax back a fax receipt confirming the receipt and how many pages went through successfully. So you don't just have to rely on your own fax machine producing proof of fax, you actually get it from the VA. That's what makes it frustrating, is when you have a fax receipt from the VA acknowledging receipt, and then they claim later. Well, the problem is, just because they receive the fax doesn't always mean that it gets associated with the right file. That's where the hiccup can be. But in any event, like you say, it's a point well made, Rick, that follow-up is so important. Well, we're about out of time. We just got a few minutes left, Rick, so if you want to mention our Coaching Into Care reminder.
Absolutely. Coaching Into Care program. This program helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be tough, can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call. That number is 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind our listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs has the Veterans Crisis Line. Call that number at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Well, it's time for us to go for this evening. I'd like to thank you all for listening to Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank Corey and Hurley Law Group, our sponsors. I'd like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. We hope you'll tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, stay safe and have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.